Thank you, everyone, for joining us. What I'm going to do tonight is a lot of fun. I love history. I love Jewish history, and I'm interested in American history as well, so to put them together is really exciting. And as I just mentioned, this really runs in my veins, in particular this evening's topic. We're going to be looking at three: Jews and Civil War, Jews and Civil Rights, and then we'll have to see what this means. And people are asking me, what are you even talking about? Jews and Black Lives Matter. Len's already got his defenses up, and he's ready to duke it out.
Can I just
so we'll have to figure out what that means.
Since you're interested in this subject, you know why Union Street is called Union Street here?
I do not. I guess that's fine.
Because the Union troops marched down Union Street to the train station to go to war.
Uh-huh. The next wave went. That's remarkable.
Not a very big street.
Wow.
Not a very big street.
It could be one time that it went all the way to the train station.
Amazing.
That
we're just getting started. Fantastic. Grab a chair. Okay. So those are going to be our three topics. And to me, each and every single one of these is close to my heart. And we're going to look at them in sort of a three-part, obviously it's historically chronological. But what I want to examine in particular is the Jewish attitude towards civil rights, both historically and normatively. In other words, what happened and what ought to happen. In other words, from a Torah perspective, which is not going to be our focus as much today, but especially next week, what's the Torah's attitude towards civil rights? And we'll see that in the 1960s, there were a number of Orthodox rabbis who spoke out very explicitly in very important ways about exactly this subject, and that's what I'm going to come to next week. But for tonight, what I really want to focus our attention on is more on the historical side of it. And in this case, as we'll see, and this is going to be part of our puzzle for this evening, is that we're familiar with the prominent role that Jews played in the civil rights movement, and sort of brought up, I think, correctly on this notion that Jews played an outsized and very important role, and that it's sort of in our DNA. After all, we were the ones who were enslaved in Egypt. We understood perhaps first or very early on what discrimination is about, and the Torah says you should remember that you were a stranger in a land that was not yours, and you should therefore be compassionate toward the orphaned and the widow, and so on and so forth. So this is really hardwired in many ways into who we are, and then there's the whole liberal Jewish piece to this as well, but more than that, sort of the sense of responsibility for fair treatment against discrimination for all members of society. It's something that I think is very much who we are, and that manifests itself in the 20th century. One of the interesting things is that we're going to examine this evening is that during the Civil War, it wasn't necessarily that way. And that Jews, in many instances, and we're going to examine three prominent examples, Jews did not necessarily en masse oppose slavery. Jews were divided just like most people were divided. And Jews, of course, lived both in the South and in the North. And so we're going to examine, in particular, why it is and how do we understand this phenomenon that there were a number of Jews who either outright supported or were engaged in the Confederacy and supported slavery. And even those who were in the North who did not necessarily own slaves or outright support slavery sometimes did not stand up in the same way that we would 100 years later. What happened? What's the difference? How do we understand this phenomenon? But before we come to some examples of Jews either outright supporting the Confederacy or at least being tacitly accepting of what was happening down in the South, I want to start with just a word of introduction. So one of the interesting things about American Jewish history is that the demographics have shifted so dramatically. Prior to about 1830, many, many, many Jews lived in the South. The largest single Jewish community until the 1830s in America, any guesses?
Charleston.
Right, Charleston, South Carolina. I mean, right? And overwhelmingly so for a very long period of time. It's a very interesting phenomenon. Approximately, by the time you get to the Civil War, it's a smaller percentage, both in Charleston. It was no longer the largest Jewish community. I think at that time it was already New York. But it remained a prominent bastion of Judaism and of the Jewish community. And by the time you get to the Civil War, things have begun to shift. Approximately one-fifth of the Jews in America live in the South. Approximately one-fifth of Jews in America live in the South. Many Jews serve in the Civil War. Historians estimate, anyone want to guess? Wild guesses. How many Jews lived in America in 1861? Maybe you want to hazard a guess. Just to give you a sense of how much we've grown. Well, how many Jews now in America?
3 million.
Okay, it depends how you count those censuses. What?
8 million? Is it?
No. It's about 14 million Jews in the world, they estimate now. Okay, just when it's around half, right? It's like the tipping point, right? So it's around 6-7 million in Israel, and then the rest are scattered. So I think it's 2-3. I didn't check specifically. I think it's like 2-3 million Jews in America, roughly. That's the estimate. No, now, today. So I said 2-3 million, roughly, depending on, because some of the censuses count patrilineal descent, and some of them don't, and all those kinds of issues. So, you know, maybe from a halakhic perspective, it will come out a little bit smaller, but right, that's the ballpark that we talk about this time, 150,000.
Wow.
That's big. Okay?
That's big.
It's big.
Why
say it's big? I mean, we've grown so much.
Yeah. 150,000 Jews?
That's it.
150,000 Jews in the United States of America.
150,000 Jews in America in 1860.
That's a large number for that time.
For that time. Okay, so I think right, Oman's onto something in the sense that this is prior to the major population waves that we're familiar with, right? Immigration. Talk about the 1880s and we talk about the 1920s. I mean, this is when the masses of Jews came from Eastern Europe in particular and other places as well. So, you know, whether it's surprising or not, and if we did the full American Jewish history course, we'd obviously examine that in depth. But at this time, 150,000, one-fifth are living in the South, so roughly 30,000 Jews living in slavery territories in the United States at the time of the Civil War. Jews, of course, served alongside their American brethren during the Civil War. Some debate among historians, let's say roughly 10,000 Jews served, maybe a little bit less, maybe a little bit more, but roughly 10,000 Jews served altogether, 7,000 in the North, 3,000 in the South. Those are the historical estimates that they have. Interestingly enough, roughly 600 Jews are said to have died during the Civil War. 600 Jews died, just by comparison. We don't know. It was a little bit more Union, but it was more or less divided equally. In fact, what's one of the interesting things is that the Union lost substantially more than the South did in terms of numbers of soldiers who fell on the battlefield, roughly 350,000. 350,000 Union soldiers fell. The bloodiest war in American history by far for us. 250,000 in the South. 600,000. It's a massive, stunning number. I don't remember exactly offhand. It was something like, how many Americans were there altogether at that time? It was something like, it's much smaller. It was, I think like it was like 3 million or something like that. Is that small? I think it may have been because again, so much of it is immigration. If memory serves, then it was 3 million, which would mean, if you do the math, right, that roughly 1 in 5 Americans died during the Civil War.
20%.
Okay, right. That's amazing.
Jews fighting Jews in Civil War.
And there's some stories about brothers who fought on opposite sides and all of that.
If you think about the male population, it was really decimated.
That's right. That's right. Just even if you assume 50-50.
Yeah.
Just remarkable. And slaves were, in other words, African Americans were a relatively small percentage, in particular in the South. It was only in 1864-1865, in other words, at the bitter end, that the Confederacy voted to allow African American slaves at least to enlist. So it narrows the slice of population even smaller. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting. One thing that I observed, I'm not sure if there's literature about it, is that among the Jewish community, if you do the math, right, if there were 300, right, if there were, what do we say, 300, no, there's no, sorry, if there were 15,000 Jews, excuse me, living there at the time, and 600 died, roughly. So percentage-wise, that's far smaller than in the general population, right? So I don't know. It's right. It's about 5 to 6 times less, which I think is very interesting. I'm not sure why that is, and I don't know if there have been historical studies apparently enlisted, which is interesting. But why was that? You know, how did that come to be? I'm not really sure as to the background. So be that as it may, we have a small but substantial population of Jews who are living in the South, but still 4 out of 5 Jews at this point are already living in the Free States. So we still have a solid majority, 8% of the Jewish community are living in the North, and yet we're going to examine a number of these instances in which Jews, interestingly enough, were not on the side that we would today call civil rights. Now I think part of what we learn from history and part of what we learn from class like this is the pitfalls of anachronism. So in other words, yes, we can say we stand squarely against slavery, but I think it's also important to understand that we don't want to be anachronistic. In other words, we don't want to project the present onto the past and to say, well, of course Jews would have opposed slavery, duh. You know, obviously, it was far more complicated than that. We know that, although with high school students, sometimes it's interesting to have that conversation. You can't assume that someone living in the 1860s would have looked reasonably at every problem the same way that you do today. You know, and then that takes some learning and some maturation in order to get there, but we know that that's the case. So I want to just examine three cases in particular of notable Jews or Jewish instances of support or at least a sense of, again, tacit admission that one need not speak out publicly against slavery in a way that we might have come to expect in terms of how we see Jews in the civil rights movement. So the first one is individual that you have right here on the sheet. It's by the name of Judah P. Benjamin. We're quite familiar with this individual. By the end of the class, he was clearly Jewish. He was clearly completely non-observant. So again, today's class is about Jews. It's not necessarily about halachic Judaism or about normative Jewish approaches. But Judah P. Benjamin is a fascinating historical personality who was at his time one of the most prominent Confederate statesmen. We're going to see that he was Jefferson Davis's right-hand man in many respects. He, before he died, he burnt all his correspondences.
Burnt?
The whole thing. To the ground. He didn't want to be disgraced. He didn't want to be associated with the losers, right? And all of that. And so as a result, historians have spent considerably less attention on personalities such as Benjamin as they did on a Jefferson Davis for obvious reasons, but a John Calhoun and some other personalities that were involved in the Confederacy at that time. So he hasn't received that level of attention, but in his time, as we'll see, he was a very important figure in this movement. So there's a little bit of historical background. So he's born in 1811. Okay, so he's born August 11th, 1811. He dies May 6th, 1884. Okay, so 1811, 1884. He is a lawyer. Okay, so he's Jewish. He's a lawyer. You'll forgive me. It's happened before. It'll happen again. Right? Okay. He wasn't a rabbi. It's I guess, not surprising. But by the way, we have coming in a number of weeks, we have a fascinating scholar by the name of Zev Eleff. Dr. Zev Eleff, for those familiar, I just learned on Monday night that he grew up, and yes, everyone here knows him as a baby. I had no idea. He's apparently a little kid. And he now lives in Chicago. He's someone I'm friendly with, and becoming increasingly a friend. He's an extremely accomplished scholar for a 30-something. He's published 6 books. Published his first book as a 21-year-old or something like that, undergraduate at Yeshiva University. He's also founded a prominent website that is at the cutting edge of providing modern Orthodox intellectual content to our community. It's called The Lair House. Have you heard of it? The Lair House?
Okay.
L-E-H-R-H-A-U-S. Franz Rosenzweig started a Beit Midrash in Germany. In his 19th century, called Lair House, which means study hall. It's German for Beit Midrash. Some would say Yiddish. The Lair House. Zed is one of the 3 major people who spearheaded it, along with a cousin of mine named Ari Lam, and a third friend named Shlomo Zuckier, who's up in Yale, whose Miral Hillebrand was here visiting today. She's in Yale now. He's the JLIC, and there's the Orthodox rabbi on campus there for her. He's a good friend as well. So 3 of them collaborated to build this website. I started publishing there recently, so I put up 3 pieces. It's a lot of fun to hear the feedback in the community. Those who know Bert Morris, yeah. Stuart Gassner's father-in-law. He's a good friend. He comes a lot to the community and the Beit Midrash and all that. So he just read one of my pieces. You can take a look.
Good.
It's a lot of fun. It's getting around. So anyhow, so Zev is now we correspond often for these kinds of things, so we've become friendly. So Zev has actually written a lot of work. I just mentioned rabbis in the 19th century. He's written a pioneering book based on his dissertation work at Brandeis about layperson and rabbinic relationships during the 19th century, and how actually many shuls did not want to have rabbis in the beginning of the 19th century. And the lay people said, we got this. We don't need a rabbi. And then by the end of the 19th century, all of a sudden rabbis are running American Orthodoxy. and what accounts for this sort of sea change. It's very interesting. So Judah P. Benjamin, when he was a young man, probably the rabbinate, he wasn't from some, it's all in jest, but it wasn't even an option when he was born. By the time he died already, it was considered to be not a lawyer, not a doctor, anything like that, but, I don't know if it was a fine Jewish profession, but it was a plausible Jewish profession by the time of his passing. I didn't go that far. Respectable, maybe not, but at least they paid a salary of some sort. Be that as it may, he was a lawyer. He rose to the position of U.S. Senator in Louisiana, and he was actually the first U.S. senator in U.S. Jewish senator in history, with one exception. But that other individual, I forget the name offhand, that other individual actually renounced his Judaism and became a Christian. So he was the only Jewish. He was the first Jewish senator not to renounce his Judaism in holding office. He wasn't from, he wasn't observant, he wasn't a Joe Lieberman, but he was the first in that respect. His parents were British. He was born in the West Indies. The family settled in Charleston, South Carolina. He rose up the ladder. He became a wealthy slave owner as part of his as an outgrowth of his financial success, and ultimately became an eloquent backer of slavery. He was a spokesperson for the legitimacy of the South's core values. When the Confederacy seceded, he resigned his position on the U.S. Senate and joined the Confederacy, and he was buddies with Jefferson Davis, who appointed him to a range of positions. So he was, at one point, he was the Attorney General. First, I think he was the Attorney General of the Confederacy. Then he became the Secretary of War, which is obviously a highly influential position. There was a big issue around a battle in Roanoke Islands, which is in North Carolina, just south of Virginia. And he was blamed for that loss, and so Davis had to boot him out of that position, Secretary of War, but he made him Secretary of State instead. So this is, he was really, really chush of. He fled initially with Jefferson Davis and the others in the inner circle when the war had been lost. Of course, Jefferson Davis was captured, and he managed to get away from the party, and he escaped to Europe, and he lived out the rest of his life in Europe, and he rose to become one of the leading lawyers at the time there as well. And he had accomplished much the same in America. So he was a person clearly of tremendous intelligence, ability, could easily climb the ladder in his profession, and was extremely highly regarded by so many of the people who were involved in the Confederacy at that time. So here you have one of the most prominent Jews of this era, who is an eloquent spokesperson on behalf of slavery and a leading figure in the Confederacy. The only reason we don't hear about him more often is because he burnt his historical records, so you can't write a legitimate biography because we just don't have the raw materials. Historians just don't have enough to work with. Nonetheless, I gave you on the sheet here, he is the subject of a major biography entitled Judah P. Benjamin, Confederate Statesman. You can go find it online, and it's widely available on Amazon. I'm not taking a cut, but you can find it there. But it gets better than that. His face appeared on some of the bills that were issued by the Confederate government.
Who's the writer? Meade?
Where are you? Yeah, Meade. Robert Meade. Robert Meade. M-E-A-D-E. Check it out. All right. Judah P. Benjamin. That's his face on a Confederate commitment to repay a loan by January 1st, 1880. So this is issued. If you take a look where it's under his image on page 1 at the bottom, it says authorized by an act of Congress, right? CSA stands for Confederate States of America. Okay, can't make this stuff up. August 18, 1861. And this is a loan of $1,000, and the commitment is to repay, if you take a look at the top left, by, right?
January 1st, 1880.
Okay? So we're going to repay it essentially within less than 19 years.
8%?
What? Yeah.
8%? Is that the interest rate?
I don't know if that was what was common, but that was the interest rate on this particular transaction. The Confederacy, their biggest issue, or one of their biggest issues, was they didn't have financial backing. They were just poverty-stricken. It hindered the war effort and was one of the major factors that led to the, according to many historians anyway, that led to the Union's success. There he is. This is Jew from the Confederacy greasing the front of the Confederate currency at the time. If you take a look at the next page, you have a classic picture of Confederate chieftains. Now, if you're wondering what that is on the right, you see how it's sort of cut off with some other things? Right? This is one of the many documents that I have here from a recent trip to the Jewish Museum, okay, which I know, Len, you can speak about after the class. But I think it's whatever one says of its certain elements of the approach, I think that it actually contains some remarkable historical documents. It's absolutely fascinating on many counts. And they have a whole range of different materials, both on the Civil War and on the Civil Rights Movement. And we're going to be incorporating those. I went and I asked someone, Tove and I had the opportunity to go over a break. I went over vacation, and the nerd that I am, I said, I'm giving these classes. I have to see their exhibits. I don't care anything else in the museum. I'm making a beeline for these two exhibits, right, for the area where they have the Civil War and the Civil Rights Movement. And they actually granted me permission, no problem at all, to any pictures you want, put in any source sheets you're interested in, no problem at all. And it's no problem. And it was actually the most awkward museum visit I've ever had, because people were coming over to me and like kind of looking at me as I'm sitting there with my camera shooting through the cases. Like, it's with permission. They're really excited about it. I promise you it's okay. Like that the whole time. But it's actually pretty amazing. They have some things on their website, but much more there. So this is one of the many things that I was excited to see. So Jefferson Davis is obviously the big one in the middle, and then on top you have, okay, the top picture is yours truly. Don't ask me to go through the other names and the other faces. I tried to find it online. I wasn't able to. But there he is. If you take a look at the next page, you've got also a $2 bill. Who wouldn't love to get their hands these days on a $2 bill? I know my son would. Okay? We said... Just the other day, my wife says, we have $2. So Batal says, 10 years old. He says, a $2 bill, Ima? She said, no, just $2. Like, what can you do?
You know,
they
can get $2.
No, we can go. Should go to the bank and get. But he was very excited. Like, maybe I'll get my hands on the $2. You just don't see them as regularly as you used to. So back in the day, though, they were all the rage. So there it is. And if you take a look at the right, you see not just his face with the other states, the chieftains from the Confederacy, but you see his name gracing not just the promissory note, the loans, but the $2 bill as well. Now, you might imagine that this experience would have been a difficult one for him. And one of the things that's really interesting is that while we don't have firsthand records from him explaining his experience, describing what was it like to be a Jew in the Confederacy and sitting around the table at a time that was not so modern, when this was not necessarily the norm, right? Again, he was the first Jew, the one before him, abandoned his faith so that he could be accepted into the North, right? And the South had similar, its own texture, but similar biases very often as well. In particular, there was a Senator Ben Wade of Ohio. Yeah,
is there any indication that the Jews of the South at that time had the similar affection as the Christian Zionists have presently for the Jews and for Israel? Is that a far off question?
No, it's fine. I don't think so. I think that they were very loyal, as we'll see, to the South. They really, really will. Where they had traumatic experiences in Europe. They came over these earliest waves of immigration. Many of the Jews went south, as we said. They made lives there. They were able to support themselves, whether it was with cotton on plantations and owning slaves, and that was very common for Southern Jews. And they had a lot of loyalty to their homelands. And it wasn't, you know, at
German,
that time...
Spanish immigrant?
It was a mix. It was a mix. There were many Germans who were there, but not only. There were some French, a handful. I think it was a mix. I don't think it was anyone in one place. And anyhow, so already when he was in the Senate, they gave him a hard time. And there was one individual by the name of Ben Wade who gave him an especially difficult time, so you have that here. So he got up on the Senate floor at one point. Judah Benjamin is an Israelite in Egyptian clothing. Israelite in Egyptian clothing. So here's the back at you. So said Senate, then Senator Benjamin, it is true that I am a Jew. And when my ancestors were receiving the Ten Commandments from the immediate deity, amidst the thundering and lightnings of Mount Sinai, the ancestors of my opponent were herding swine in and forests of Great Britain. Okay, so if you think the Senate is entertaining now, okay, that's just how it always was. It was like that back in Great Britain as well. Still is, right? I mean, you know how it is there, right? Your ability to insult and to dig at your political opponent, right? Mm-hmm. That's how you make it in Parliament.
Also from Great Britain.
Right, something like that. But back and forth they went. There is a later poem that was written about Judah Benjamin by Stephen Vincent Benet. So I gave that to you here. And so he imagines what it was like for Benjamin to sit around the table. Judah P. Benjamin, the dapper Jew, seal-sleek, black-eyed, lawyer, and epicure. Able, well-hated, right? Face alive with life. Looked round the council chamber with a slight perpetual smile he held before himself continually like a silk-ribbed fan. His quick, shrewd, fluid mind weighed Gentiles in an old balance. The eyes stared, searching. I am a Jew. What am I doing here?
This is John Brown's body. That's the name of the poem?
That's this. It's part of a collection. But that's... So that gives you a sense as to what it must have been like. Again, that's the best that we can do. But this is one very prominent example of a Jew, again, an outspoken advocate for slavery, and obviously very engaged. And he, as we'll see, he's not the only one, but he's one example. I'm going to turn now to a second, and this has almost been a little bit less time on less prominent, but still interesting nonetheless, Moses Ezekiel. Also a pretty Jewish biblical name. Okay, so we're two for two on biblical names, but Moses Ezekiel. So who is he? So we know where he's buried. Okay, we know where he's buried. Okay, there he is. Okay, in where are they all buried? Where the...
Virginia?
Okay, yeah.
Arlington?
What? At Arlington, yeah. In Arlington. And he is a very interesting individual. He was a Richmond-born Jew. That's another prominent but less prominent Jewish community. He was a highly decorated Confederate soldier who became developed even more fully into a world-renowned sculptor. He's a sculptor. Very interesting person. In fact, if you go to Arlington National Cemetery, there is, and you find this online as well, if you don't have time to make the trip, anytime soon there's a very ornate Confederate monument which he was commissioned to make in the aftermath of the Civil War, where he had after everything had happened. He was much younger than Judah P. Benjamin. He was born 1844, died in 1917. So he was a kid during the Civil War. Essentially, he was a teenager, basically, and that was he. I didn't give this in, but that's him, by the way, on top number seven. I didn't give this. I originally had this picture, but I had to take it off because there is a. If you go to the Jewish Museum, there is a very prominent statue there that's now outside of the Jewish Museum since 2010. Anyone know what I'm talking about? Are you familiar with that? Called Lady Liberty. Lady Liberty. Problem with Lady Liberty is that she's very beautifully made, but she sort of has under her wing a young boy who is not dressed. Not so young, though. So I didn't bring it in. If you come forward, take a look. But if you go, it's actually very interesting, though. Essentially what it is you have a Lady Liberty, sort of like you have in New York, and she has under her wings are two things. I say wings, as it were, because she's spread out that way in a protective gesture. She has a young boy, it would seem, who is holding sort of a bowl, and the bowl and the boy are facing upward. And that represents sort of the elixir of religion and religious liberty. And then you have at the bottom, you have an eagle, right? Which is obviously symbolic of America, and it's also sort of looking down, and it's attacking some sort of snake. What's going on? What's this all about? Okay. It's not related to the Confederacy, actually. Mm-hmm. Totally separate. It was a different commission that he was asked to create.
Snake? Mm-hmm. They have a snake in the Garden of Eden?
Okay. Well, Lady Liberty is protecting the religious boy. So what does that presumably represent? Okay. So America is a beacon of religious liberty. Okay. And the eagle is then crushing... Okay, a snake What?
Tyranny.
Good. Tyranny, anyone who would seek to oppress people of good faith who are good citizens and yet are believers, right? And some sort of discrimination or whatever it might be. What is this? This was actually commissioned in, I believe, in 1876. In 1876, by B'nai B'rith. By B'nai B'rith. To celebrate the centennial of the United States of America and its having served as a place of freedom and liberty for people of faith and for the Jewish community in particular. It was placed in this far-off park, which is not too far from us, which you might exercise in or drive through, called Fairmount Park. It was there for 100 years. Huh? It was there for 100 years, from 1876 until 1976. It was then moved to another location in Philadelphia. And I think in 2010, it was moved in front of the National Museum of Jewish History, and you can still see it there. That was created by our very own Moses Ezekiel. Very different kind of work, but still interesting. Again, bringing his Jewish heritage into his work. And next time you take a visit, you'll see it's right, it's sort of around the corner from the main entrance, but it's right there toward the front of the museum. You go, what?
Go online.
You have it there. Yeah, I just, it looked like there was some genitalia that were exposed, so that's why we didn't bring it, but it's there. So that's a really interesting one. But again, Moses Ezekiel was a Confederate soldier. He's buried, again, with the Confederate soldiers. Okay, and even though he didn't die with them, he lived a fairly long life, but he was a well-recognized and well-decorated Confederate soldier, so he was buried in Arlington. And together with the others who were buried there, it's simply engraved that they are all buried in and remembered in simple obedience to duty as they understood it. That's what's inscribed in Arlington.
Judah Benjamin.
What? He was in England. Remember, he fled.
Oh, okay.
He fled. Yeah. He never came back. He was buried there. Yeah, so that's the story. But he's buried there together with the other ones, not Benjamin, but Moses Ezekiel. So that's a second example. There's a third one of a rabbi by the name of Rabbi Max Michelbacher. Rabbi Max Michelbacher, not as well known, but he did a couple, also fairly well known, he did a couple of really interesting things. The first thing he did is he wrote a prayer for the Confederacy. A prayer for the Confederacy. So that's at the bottom of page 4. Okay, so let's see his tefillah for the Confederate government. Unbelievable. This prayer was composed by Reverend Max Michelbacher of Congregation Beth Ahava. Okay, Beth Ahava, Beit Ahava, in Richmond, Virginia. It might actually be. And distributed to Jewish Confederate soldiers. Okay, so this was meant, he was essentially a pastor for the Jewish soldiers. So Shema Yisrael, okay, page 5. Shema Yisrael, right? Adoshem Elokeinu, right? And it's a very frum prayer, right? Because he cuts it off, so it shouldn't be Shemos and have the Shem Hashem in all 9 yards. Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. O God of the universe. Again, a Jewish soldier might recite this on the battlefield. One of the 3,000. Although unworthy through my manifest transgressions, I approach the seat of thy mercy to crave thy favor and to seek thy protection. I supplicate thy forgiveness, O most merciful Father, for the many transgressions and the oft-repeated disobedience which caused thee to command destruction over me. Behold me now, O my Father, supplicating thy protection. Thou who art near when all others aid faileth, O spare me, guard me from the evil that is impending. So this is the soldier out on the battlefield. Okay, this is not Sahal. This is the Confederate army. And he says, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, please, Shema Yisrael, right? In other words, right? Those who were here with Rabbi Targan, right? The anthem of Jewish martyrdom. He described it as the third and final phase, beginning with Rabbi Akiva and for the last 2,000 years, saying Shema Yisrael, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, right? If it came to that, or ideally protect me. This once happy country is inflamed by the fury of war. A menacing enemy is arrayed against the rights, liberties, and freedom of this, our Confederacy. The ambition of this enemy has dissolved fraternal love. It's all the Union's fault. The hand of fraternity has been broken asunder by the hands of those who sit now in council and meditate our chastisement with the chastisement of scorpions. Our firesides are threatened. The foe is before us with the declared intention to desecrate our soil, to murder our people, and to deprive us of the glorious inheritance which was left to us by the immortal fathers of this once great republic. Here I stand out with many thousands of the sons of the sunny south to face the foe, to drive them back, and to defend our natural rights. Right? Invoking Jefferson, in other words. Our natural rights. O Lord, God of Israel, be with me in the hot season of the contending strife. Protect and bless me with health and courage to bear cheerfully the hardships of war. O Lord, ruler of nations, destroy the power of our enemies. Grant not the longings of the wicked. Suffer not his wicked device to succeed, lest they exalt themselves. Selah. Sela, right? Yeah. Amen, Sela, like we say in the right in the prayers on Shabbat morning. Amen, right? Sela. As for the heads of those that encompass me about, let the mischief of their own lips cover them. Right? Coals be cast upon them. He cites Tehillim and he davens to the Almighty, etc. And jumping down a little bit, give unto the officers of the army. Okay, this might sound familiar also, right? Give unto the officers. If you ever hear the English version of the prayer for America and its soldiers, it's highly similar language that's used in the prayer. Give unto the officers of the army and of the navy. It doesn't say army, navy. We don't generally distinguish. Although in the Tzahal one, originally it was those two, and then we added Chel HaAvir.
Yeah.
And so you say all three. Right? The Confederate States Enterprise, fortitude and undaunted courage. Teach them the ways of war and the winning of victory. Guard and preserve, although the peasants. This is, okay? This is also, by the way, from the English. You hear it, or go look it up. It's remarkably reminiscent. Guard and preserve, O Lord, the President of the Confederate States and all officers who have the welfare of the country truly at heart. Bless all my fellow citizens. Guard them against sickness, famine, they prosper and increase. Hear me further, O Lord, when I pray to thee for those on earth dearest to my heart. Bless my father, mother, brothers, and sisters. If married, right, insert here, my wife and children. Directions and all, bless them with the earthly and heavenly good. May they always look unto thee. May they find in thee their trust and strength. Right, O Lord, be with me. Always show me the way. I have to go to be prepared. Meet there, the here and hereafter. So Olam Hazeh and Olam Haba. I hope my faith and strength are with thee, O Lord, my God forever. In thee is my trust. So American language as well. For thy salvation do I hope, O Lord. Sedra Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. The prayer for the Confederate soldier. He was, at that time, it wasn't as actually around that time began sharpened. He was, I think he was unaffiliated, but he tended more toward that more liberal element. But clearly a deeply religious man.
The structure is very similar to what you say, the sort of personal supplication of Rabbeinu Shalom. That's how it starts.
Saying, on the Yamim Narayim?
Right. It starts like, and interesting, if you look at the fourth paragraph, it says, our Lord, ruler of nations, destroy the power of our enemies. It doesn't say destroy our enemies, the power of our enemies. And then the remainder in quote is from Tehillim. So none of this prayer, except for the part from Tehillim, is really wishing bad upon the other side. It's interesting.
Just their ways.
Yeah.
And they say here, when he says
like the Gemara's classic Gemara in Brachot, where Beruria castigates Rabbi Meir. Right? Beruria and Meir were married, a classic power rabbinic couple, Tanaitic version thereof. And there was once, the Gemara tells a story that there was once a neighbor, Rabbi Meir, who was giving him a terribly hard time. And it got so miserable, so difficult, that he finally said, God should bring death upon this person. That's how horrible it was. And his wife gave him, Moshe Beruria said to him, and says, you know, it says in Tehillim, in Mizmor Kuftal 104, we say, Yitamu chata'im min ha'aretz, Rusha'im odeinam. Yitamu chata'im. So she says, why does it say chata'im should be erased from the earth? In the meaning of the Pasuk. Instead, right, it should say chotim, sinners. Chata'im, she says, means the sins. Don't pray that, right? That they die. Pray that they change their behavior. Like that's what you should daven for, right? So that sense of, right? So that's mechavin to Beruria.
So he says here to drive them back and defend our natural rights. You're talking about slavery.
Sure.
Our natural rights.
Oh yeah, of course. No.
So he believes that our natural rights is slavery.
Absolutely, there's no question. Well, when it said, according to so many. When it said, right, that all men have the right, all men were created equal. What does that mean? What did the founding fathers mean? If we're an originalist,
I guess.
Okay, right?
And landowners.
Right, white, male, maybe they have to be WASPs, I'm not sure. Right, landowners, right? I mean...
And Jews would fall into that because they're probably Jews who are landowners.
Well, right, and they're not, obviously not WASPs, as anyone living in old town mainline areas knows, but...
I don't think that...
It's interesting.
That term came afterwards, though, way after.
No, obviously the terminology was different. But, yeah, it was complicated. It wasn't obvious that all this was extended to everyone, and so you could make the argument that that was, right, that's the property. The ownership piece, right? So that's it. So these are already a number of examples, and Rabbi Michelbacher actually was engaged in a friendly exchange with none other than
Robert
Ely. All right, so here we go. Okay, so this is right. So this is the army rabbi, essentially, right, communicating with the general, and so he writes. Okay, headquarters, Valley Mountain, 29 August 1861. Okay, so what time of year is coming up in the Hebrew calendar? Okay, the Yom Narayim are coming. Okay, so we have to request leave. Rabbi M. J. Michelbacher, preacher, Hebrew Congregation, House of Love, right, Pitava, Richmond, Virginia. Reverend Sir, I have just received your letter of the 23rd, what would that be?
Instance
I guess. Mm-hmm. Requesting that a furlough, thank you for a furlough from the second, right, a furlough is a leave. Leave of absence in army talk. A furlough from the 2nd to the 15th September be granted to soldiers of the Jewish persuasion in the Confederate States Army that they may participate in the approaching holy services of the synagogue. Right? Yom Noraim, high holy days. It would give me great pleasure to comply with a request urgently urged by you, and which I know would be so highly appreciated by that class of our soldiers. But the necessities of war, right, so this is Robert E. Lee responding to, and right, by implication to a question to this effect from the rabbi, the necessities of war admit of no relaxation of the efforts requisite for its success, nor can it be known on what day the presence of every man may be required. I feel assured that neither you nor any member of the Jewish congregation would wish to jeopardize a cause you have so much at heart by the withdrawal, even for a season of a portion of its defenders. I cannot therefore grant the general furlough you desire, but you must leave to individuals to make their own applications to their several commanders, in the hope that many will be able to enjoy the privilege you seek for them. Should they be deprived of the opportunity of offering up their prayers according to the rites of their church? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Which is interesting that the word, can you imagine if someone used the word church that way in 2017?
They should be considered
church. Rabbis were called reverends. Okay, houses of worship were called churches.
I don't know what the Reform do. I don't.
Temple, they call it temple. I don't know, it's not called a church. No, I don't think. No. I don't think any contemporary Jewish institution would call its house of worship a church.
No.
It's interesting.
No,
the terminology is always changing.
It's a general term.
Oh, of course it's correct usage. Of course it's correct usage. I just think it's interesting to read. We see that many of the terms have shifted in their meaning and significance. Right? Just it would throw us off nowadays. Right? That the penitents may nevertheless be accepted by the Most High, and the petitions answered, that your prayers for the success and welfare of our cause may be granted by the great ruler of the universe is my ardent wish. Have the honor to be with high esteem, your obedient servant, Robert E. Lee, General Commander. Can't make this stuff up, okay? So you get a sense of mutual respect. At least that's how it was communicated from Robert E. Lee. So you have now three prominent instances. You have, right, the Confederate statesman, you have the Confederate soldier and sculptor, and now you have the rabbi, right? So you have the army rabbi, essentially, the chief rabbi, apparently, of the Confederate Jewish army, all coming down on this side. Now, on the topic of rabbis, I want to come to a fourth instance of a prominent rabbi, and then we'll see it's really a group of rabbis who were perhaps unexpectedly, perhaps expectedly, supportive of slavery at this time. And if you turn to page 7, I gave you a picture of a rabbi by the name of Rabbi Morris Raphael. I hope I'm pronouncing it correctly. R-A-P-H-A-L-L. Who was Rabbi Morris Raphael? He was the rabbi of what was then and is now known as B'nai Jeshurun Synagogue. Anyone familiar with B'nai Jeshurun in New York?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, very prominent Reform temple in New York. It was not Reform at that time. Reform didn't really exist in that way at that time. It was very interesting. That synagogue was founded in 1825 as a fairly traditional shul. Orthodox. It didn't exist. The terminology didn't exist in 1825. By 1860, it did exist. But in 1825, really didn't. So things are starting to get bad. Storm clouds are beginning to gather. And Lincoln calls for a day of fasting, of reflection, in advance of what ultimately became the Civil War. This is in December to January 1860 to 1861. And so around this time, rabbis begin to weigh in. And Rabbi Raphael gets up, he declares a day of fasting, mourning, and everyone in his shul comes to daven and to say Tehillim and the whole nine yards, and he delivers a major address. It was a major address in his time. In other words, the moment he was giving it, he knew it was a major address, but it became a really major address once the press got hold of it, because it went everywhere. That's right, it went viral. Okay, it was on YouTube, the whole nine yards. They got everything. And this was it. And this is actually a copy. This is a replica. This is not an original. It says duplicate. But this is a, I took this picture in the museum, although you can find it, you can find it essentially the same thing online, but I figured once that I was having fun, I may as well use that image. Bible view of slavery, a discourse in Rabbi Raphael goes through that. It's very long. It didn't give you the whole thing. I just gave you the introduction that he appended about a week and a half later when he published the sermon. And essentially what he does, it's a three-part argument in favor of the Bible supporting slavery. Prominent rabbi gets up essentially in front of the American world, right? The American Jewish and Gentile community, in effect, that's what ended up happening, and declares immediately ahead of the Civil War that all this is legitimate and the Torah endorses slavery. Now, he does not say, in fairness, he does not say the Torah endorses Southern slavery, which he considers far more, not just demeaning, but abusive and problematic than the Torah's version thereof, which is much more humane. And he makes that point. But he nonetheless makes a big stink about it. In principle, the Torah supports slavery. And everyone goes wild.
Was he in New York?
Oh, so this is the irony. He's in New York, and he's writing against slavery. Gets better. There's a rabbi, David Einhorn, who was at the, the Har Sinai congregation. Har Sinai congregation, which is in Baltimore at the time, I don't think it exists anymore. He is a reform rabbi. He was brought over from Bavaria, right, from Germany, to come and be the rabbi in Har Sinai congregation, a very prominent reform rabbi. And what happens is, essentially, he gets up, and he gets wind of Rabbi Raphael's sermon, and he delivers a blistering response in the opposite direction. So you can't make this stuff up. The rabbi in New York gives the sermon in favor of slavery, okay? And the rabbi down in Baltimore, right, calls him out and says, this is a huge Chilul Hashem, right? Okay? What happens? Okay, Rabbi Raphael managed somehow to survive, I mean, professionally survive the firestorm. He stayed his job. Rabbi Einhorn had to flee to the north. That was it. His job was over. They brought him over from Europe to be the founding rabbi of this major Baltimore congregation. He was done. It was over. He spoke out in favor of abolition. That was it. That was the end of his time. I gave you some of the. We're not going to have time to read through everything.
Yeah, but again, there's obviously in the Chumash there's laws of slave law,
sure,
owning slaves and how, right, how to treat them and everything. So
right.
So we know the Bible endorsed.
And in the 1860s, right, when these questions, I mean, you wouldn't hear that kind of sermon. You wouldn't expect to hear that nowadays, I don't think. If a rabbi got up in one of our synagogues
and say the Bible
on MLK, around MLK Day, and right, and delivered a sermon in favor of slavery, right, that would be a little bit curious, I think. It's fair to say. But in right, that's the saying, that's the historical
slavery
context.
Slavery was the time at the Bible. Slavery was the time in the 1860s.
Right,
mid-1800s, unfortunately.
That's it. So he goes, this is, God bless, this is his preparatory remarks to his publication. And he says, it's hard for me to listen, God bless. It's hard for me to listen, this is what he claims. He says, when the discourse which is now placed before the public in pamphlet form was first delivered, I little anticipated that would attract and occupy public attention in the matter and to the extent which it has done. Which, I don't know. Yeah, you know, he got up from this pulpit and made a big deal about how the North is wrong and the South is right. Not quite, but it was borderline. The subject has not been chosen by myself. I was called upon to expose a pernicious fallacy. Under a strong sense of duty, I did it not by any reasoning of my own, right? This is, right? This is what Brian's saying, but by a statement of fact, supported by the authority of Scripture. Like, don't put it on me. You ask me what the Bible thinks. This is what I'm just presenting, the biblical view. It's not, it's, don't blame me. He says, Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, they all own slaves. I mean, yeah, don't put this on me. Right? Cham, that curse goes all the way back. It's the earliest stages of known human history. Right? It's the curse, Eved Avadim, Yaveh Achav. I mean, this is not... that's what he says. That such a sober statement and the inferences to be deduced therefrom should prove very unpalatable to men of extreme opinions, that they should do their utmost to refute my discourse was naturally to be expected, which seems to contradict what he said. I really don't understand whether he thought it would cause a firestorm. He didn't think it would cause a firestorm. It's almost like he's playing dumb. I don't know. But, you know, he's kind of making the argument, look, like, don't put this on me. I just put truth out there. It's like a piece, an anti-PC argument, like you're in today's world, right? Saying like, you know, you can't handle the truth, okay? Don't ask for it. Sorry.
In the Bible, though, they also talk about releasing a slave. Right?
Yeah, and he discusses that as well, by the way. He gives it, it's pretty comprehensive for a public sermon. I mean, it's not an entire sefer written on this subject.
And when
he talks about refugees even, right? About what runaway slaves, and when you catch the runaway slave, and it seems to say, lo taskir evedim matunavi, you don't return the slave. And he quotes the Gemara in Kiddushin, which says, well, that's only true if it's outside of Israel, but Israel's different, and this whole thing. So he gets into all of that.
He talks about giving him compensation when they...
Yeah, he talks about that's part of the final phase of the sermon, in which he says, look, fundamentally we're opposed, but... right? Sorry, fundamentally the Torah endorses this, but it has to be humane. And he does make a big deal out of the end. But no one's listening anymore by the time they get to the end of the sermon. Both because, right, I mean, I'm being anachronistic again, but, like, it was a long sermon, clearly. I mean, the way that they sat in the pews for hours on end is stunning to a child of the 21st century, or even the 20th. But it's pretty remarkable. But also, like, he got up and defended slavery. Like, no one else heard anything. They miss the nuances. That's how it goes.
Yeah.
And right when
it probably shows also that people really didn't know Torah, because if they did, they wouldn't be surprised. We're not surprised. I mean, we're sitting here and we know Torah, so telling the truth. So we may not.
Yeah,
you know,
right. Day school, we have these nuances. The day school movement is still 70 years away. I mean, it's true. This is a highly uneducated American Jewish community. There's no question about it. Across the board. The exception of a very small handful of people. It was the Treif of Medina. I mean, all, you know, the earliest stages of rabbis in America. They came in the 1830s. Before that, there was literally nothing. So
I would imagine that Jews, like Christians at that time, you know, that even if they weren't religious, read the Bible because that was what was available to read.
I don't know to what extent. When people say they read the Bible, I really don't know what they meant by that.
I mean, certainly not the commentary.
I think the highest class was really doing serious work on the Bible. The John Adams of the world. You know, he was a Hebraist, and he really knew. I think people who got the highest tier education at that time really tried to even sometimes study Hebrew and to read the Bible as best they could. The wider community, I think, perhaps a little bit less so. I mean, they're familiar, but, you know, it doesn't necessarily mean that they read it intensively. It just sort of like it was part of their childhood.
When was the first English version of
the Bible published? In Europe, and it's, you know, centuries and centuries earlier.
But that doesn't mean that everyone had books in there.
Oh, right, sure.
Or
right.
Read them, or was, right. was literate. I don't know, 1861 right. about the... And then... You could be literate, but are you really picking up the Bible? And not, we're talking about even Gemaras. We're not only talking about, did you read the words themselves in the five books of Moses, but do you know all these other things that to us are, they're all stuff that we know. Nothing that it doesn't seem to us that we'd be so surprised by what he said here. You might have said, shut up. You know, a guy in New York, like, why did he deliver?
Well, I think my initial reaction is like, it's just like, this is the wrong moment to give the wrong thing.
Exactly.
The wrong speech at the wrong moment. Yeah. It just seems tone deaf.
Right.
Just it's just not helpful.
Right.
I think that was my initial response.
Right. Like, that's
why. Like, forget all the lumbus and, like, you know, like all of that. Like, why? What is this going to accomplish? Just as well, I was asked to speak to the subject, and I spoke the honest truth. And there's something in that.
Okay.
But there's also sort of a sense of what's going to be the impact of this sermon, and how is it going to be received in my community and in the wider community at this moment? And, you know, asking those questions, I wonder. All right, time is a little bit late, but there are two crucial pieces that I want to touch on and give some attention to. If you're interested, on page 9, you have an article. This is in Tablet Magazine much more recently, obviously. But this article points out that Rabbi Raphael was far from the only prominent rabbi to be supportive of slavery. He says that in his opinion on Lincoln and the issue of slavery, Raphael was not alone among Jewish leaders. Diplomat, playwright, and journalist Mordecai M. Noah, very prominent. Jonathan Sarna. You can see all of that there. So there's clearly a sense that this is it's not just an isolated rabbi, that he's part of a larger group in the north and in the south.
That's racist here.
What?
That's not racist.
You either. Comments that would and this stuff was
the nigger.
And this stuff was, look, even Lincoln in the Lincoln-Douglas debates of 1858, right? He held that he did not argue for full equality in citizenship. He held to three-fifths of a vote. This is Lincoln. This is the great hero of the abolitionists and still. So that's just not where people were holding in terms of their political views. On the bottom, I gave you a picture of Rabbi David Einhorn. He's the one from Har Sinai congregation. I gave you an excerpt from him, and he's nasty. He's just nasty. An ugly hatchet job on Rabbi Raphael because he thinks it's a chil Hashem, basically. So he has to call him out. So he said, and get a sense of why it so offended his own congregation. He said this in front of people in Baltimore as the war was on the immediate horizon. He says, the question simply is slavery a moral evil or not? It took Dr. Raphael, right? So this is dripping with sarcasm. Mm-hmm. A Jewish preacher to concoct deplorable farce in the name of divine authority to proclaim the justification, the moral blamelessness of servitude, and to lay down the law to Christian preachers of opposite convictions. So he says, the Jew, and this is the key line, right? A descendant of the race that offers daily praises to God for deliverance of the house of bondage in Egypt, and even today suffers under the yoke of slavery in most places in the old world, crying out to God, undertook to designate slavery as a perfectly sinless institution sanctioned by God. And impudent persons who will not believe this are met with fanatical zeal, with a sort of moral indignation. And so on. You know, it's just, it's the ultimate hypocrisy, right? The Jew lecturing the Christians about why we should be pro-slavery, right? Chil Hashem in the first order. So he's just, and the whole thing is just, it is scornful. I mean, it really is a hatchet job, and it's very ugly, but that's exactly what he did. Now, larger question, why were so many Jews so supportive? And I think a lot of it has to do with not just the Torah, because many of the Jews were non-educated, non-observant, not engaged necessarily in that way. But I think there's a larger sense in which historically, Jews of the South, first of all, felt very comfortable there. And not only felt very comfortable with their plantations and with their slaves, and that was their way of life and their only way of life. And this was that, or they would lose everything. That's right, they felt very much they wanted to be part of the community, and not even in such a self-conscious way as sometimes happened in the North. In certain ways, some Jews in the South felt even more fully accepted. Not that they were viewed as completely integrated in society at that time. It was far from perfect. There was plenty of anti-Semitism and bigotry everywhere, but in certain ways, Jews of the South, Jonathan Sarna, for example, a prominent historian, has made this argument. In certain ways, Jews felt even more comfortable sometimes in the South than they did relative to their northern brethren. And so there was this sense of allegiance, and a sense of really being part of things. And there was one, so for example, in Sue Eisenfeld, who's a columnist who writes in the Times, on April 17, 2014, around Pesach time, so she imagined this, and so she says, talks about, what did Pesach look like for Confederate Jews? You know, what did they think when they recited the Haggadah, and they were in the middle of the Civil War for those 4 years? You know, what were they thinking? You know, like what was on their mind? So she says, but just as Robert E. Lee, an army officer for 32 years, sided with his home state of Virginia against the federal government, many Jews found a homeland in Dixie over the centuries and decided they could not take up arms against it. To them, after all, they'd suffered and fled throughout the ages. The South was their new motherland, the land of milk and honey, right? So it almost replaces Israel, going back to the Zionism question, and cotton. That's a good line. And it was worth fighting for. This land has been good to all of us, one Jewish German Southerner wrote. I shall fight to my last breath. And there was really a sense of deep allegiance.
So it was my understanding that Southern Jews at that time were mostly not plantation owners, but in the mercantile.
There were many. You're right. That should be added as well. There were many who were involved in the mercantile business. There's no question.
Their customers were the slave owners.
It's the same. I mean, it's all. Their business interests were pro-slavery as well, yeah. And then everyone in the South was, and plenty of people in the North as well, frankly. We'll come to in a moment. What? Right. It's a long tradition of that, isn't there?
It is.
Shkoyach. Very good. I want to, the penultimate, second last point that I want to share is an illustration of this notion of how Northerners sometimes perhaps at anti-Semitic instincts. And this is a famous incident involving Ulysses S. Grant. So a few years ago, Jonathan Sarna, the historian that I just mentioned, wrote a fantastic, ingenious book, When Ulysses S. Grant Expelled the Jews. It's a great read. Put it on that list. It's just fantastic. Okay.
We got it for your father.
Got it. Okay, so you might be familiar with the story. So at the time, Ulysses S. Grant is the general of the North. At that time, he wasn't the general of the entire army, but he was actually in the South overseeing the Northern troops in the areas of parts of Tennessee, Mississippi, and Kentucky. So that's where he is, and he is dealing with, obviously, matters of war, but he's got this sort of side issue that keeps on coming up for him that's really, really bothering him, which is a black martin cotton trade.
A what?
Black market cotton trade.
That's what the Jews were doing.
Okay. What's happening over here, right? So the North is at war against the South, and then at the same time, there are plenty of Northerners who are, okay, engaged in, right, black under the table,
yeah.
Okay, trade with, especially in cotton, with Southerners. Right? Where does that money go? More or less directly to the war effort. Because without a war effort, there ain't, right? The whole thing is lost. Their whole way of life is over. Right? So this is a real problem for the North, right? Because essentially their own people are giving up Parnassa, right? They're supporting the war effort. So this is a problem across the board. So Grant has to deal with this like many others. He sends out his researchers to put out some feelers and find out what's going on. And he discovers there are lots of Jews involved in this. And so he signs an order known as General Order Number 11, which I gave you the text and source 18, December 17, 1862. And he says, the Jews as a class violating every regulation of trade established by the Treasury Department, and then also department orders are hereby expelled.
Tennessee.
Okay, from these areas under his watch. Okay, are hereby expelled from the Department of Tennessee, but it really means the others. The same thing for the others as well. Within 24 hours. 24 hours. Okay, so in Spain we got a lot more time in 1492 than the Jewish soldiers. Okay, got 3 months, I think. Okay.
Well, presumably he was telling them to stop, and they weren't stopping. I mean. Right.
It's not so clear what happened.
You don't think it's so clear.
Pretty clear to me.
You don't think it would have been clear that happened?
No, of course.
Yeah.
But it wasn't, the historical record shows it was not, maybe thought differently, but it was not mostly Jews. It was Jews.
Yeah,
the Jews were an even lower percentage.
Well, now it's starting Trump-like. You know,
okay.
So all Muslims, right?
Right. It's Jews at a lower percentage than many other people. Okay. And
but
so
we were
that's,
better at it.
They would have been slaving trade, and he would have said, "Let's make America grape again."
That's the story Rabbi Sachs likes to tell about the two Jews who were sitting reading newspapers at the Viennese coffee shop. You know this one? He tells it, of course, to great effect. It's that they're sitting there and they're reading, and one of them is reading the local Jewish newspaper, and the other one is reading a virulently anti-Semitic one.
Oh, yeah.
Right? So one, the guy who's reading the Jewish newspaper, is like, doing? Okay, why would you read that? It says, wouldn't you read your newspaper? This is happening, and that's happening. Okay, it's very nice. When read the anti-Semitic newspaper, the Jews are, we're filthy rich, and we control the world! It's incredible! I mean, All Rothschild. It's unbelievable. You know, so it's like that. Yeah. You know, we were good at it. And he says, no exceptions and the whole nine yards. This led to a huge outcry. I mean, there was a tremendous, tremendous pushback, and the Jews actually met with Lincoln over this. Source 19, he explains why he did it. He writes a letter to someone who was questioning, and they push back at the national level. They push back against, in other words, at the national level of the army. There was a higher up who pushed back and said, "What are you doing? Why are you doing this?" So he responds and he says, "Sir," and he explains that that it's the Jews' fault essentially that all this is happening. I had no choice but to implement this. Jews send emissaries to Lincoln. Lincoln meets with them in 1862 at the very end of the year, December 29th, and he immediately says, "This is unacceptable." He says, "This is right. This is the letter from these brothers who came from, I think, from." I want to say from Charleston, I don't know if it actually... No, but there was another... There's another one who joined them, right? But you're right, from Kentucky. And these are these Wolf and these Caskill brothers, who go, the three of them, and they meet. There's a whole legend, which I gave you in Source 21. It doesn't seem like they actually had an in-person meeting with President Lincoln, but that's sort of the myth. The way the story is told is that they had an in-person meeting, and sort of it's circulated in that way. And there's this imagined conversation. So if you take a look at the bottom of page 12, it says that they actually came to him. They received an audience with Lincoln, and it says, accompanied by Representative Gurley of Ohio, these are the Caskill brothers, at once sought an audience with the president, reaching the White House at about dusk, announcing their presence. In other words, they didn't have an appointment, they didn't send a letter, they just showed up, they knocked on the White House door, and they said, we want to talk to the president. The Jews are in trouble, right? It's like something got to be let us there, right? Unbelievable. Announcing their presence with an apology for calling at such an hour, the president sent word that he was always glad to see his friends, and shortly made his appearance. He was very popular in the Jewish community, as we'll see at the end. On learning the object of visiting, he remarked, this is the legend part of it in particular, and so the children of Israel were driven from the happy land of Canaan. Right? So in other words, this is your homeland now, Lincoln says to the Jews, the great lover of the Jewish people. This is your homeland, and we're kicking you out now. And this has many echoes in American history, the notion that this was the new Israel. It was a very prominent thing for another class in America. Caskill replied, yes, and that is why we've come into Father Abraham's bosom, asking protection. Lincoln responded, this protection they shall have at once. So that's the legend part of it, but in truth, and he says it's at once, in fact it takes a few weeks, almost a month, but within a month he does do away with the order, and it's overruled, and the Jews are permitted to come back.
Did any other kind of leave?
They left. The 32 Jews left Paddock alone. This town alone, and then others as well. That was the largest group. It wasn't huge. It wasn't a mass migration, but... Some, yes, some, no. Some were actually kicked out. Some actually left, and then... I don't know exactly where they went. I don't know exactly what happened. They came back. Unclear. That's always the question, isn't it? That is always the question. Anyhow, time is late, so I want to bring this to a conclusion, but I just want to say that there's a whole literature about how Grant then flipped. The postscript is he flipped from being... an anti-Semite to one of the great Philo-Semitic presidents of American history. He hired like 50 Jews into his government. And that despite the fact that Rabbi Isaac Meir Weiss, who's the great Reform rabbi of that generation, opposed his candidacy on grounds of anti-Semitism, he began to intercede in Romania and Russia on behalf of Jewish rights. He attended 1874. He brought his entire cabinet to the dedication of Addis Israel, which was a new congregation in Washington, D.C. He traveled to Yerushalayim. Traveled to Yerushalayim before his death, and the whole nine yards. Whole nine yards. One closing comment to kind of bring this to an end. Throughout the Civil War, or the beginning of the Civil War, many Jews were opposed to slavery. But there's good reason to think that over the course of the war, and you take a look at some of these classic books, the Jews of New York and other communities kind of changed their tune. And kind of came around more. And maybe they were just jumped on the bandwagon. Well, right? Okay, let's do away with slavery. But by the end, there's support for Lincoln, and there's support for abolition, and there's support for sort of the New World Order among many Jews of the North, Jews of the South less so. But remember, there's a relatively small amount to begin with, and the trends anyway were moving northward. And then by the 1880s, overwhelmingly, people Jews were arriving off the boat and going to areas in the North. Around this time, with this love fest that Jews began to have with Lincoln, Lincoln, of course, a few years into this, is shot. Right? Lincoln dies on April 15, 1865, and happens to be then Friday night. He's shot, I think, 7:22 p.m. Friday night. No, he dies, sorry. He's shot on Friday night, and then he dies 7:22 a.m. on Shabbos morning. It's a Shabbos morning, Shabbos Chol Hamoed, Pesach. That's when Lincoln is deceased. Word gets out around the time the Jews are in shul. Right? So they go into that, right? And that's where word gets out. The Spanish-Portuguese synagogue in New York, in particular, is well known. They recited their Hashkavah, which is their prayer for those who had passed away. They generally had reserved that for Jews. They recited publicly for Lincoln. It was a big, big thing. Rabbi Isaac Leiser, who was the reverend rabbi of Sherith Israel, of that synagogue at that time, wrote an explanation afterward as to why he made this decision, and that this is a prayer which is generally stated for Jews, but really all humans are endowed with dignity, and Selam Elokim, and if there's anyone who's deserving of this prayer, it's Lincoln, who fought for all the values of our community and of our faith, and it's a very moving explanation. But you also have, and I found this in the museum, after Lincoln's death, as Jews began to come around, and this is a fundamental shift. Jews are no longer sort of Southerners or more receptive to slavery and that Confederate culture, and they move more and more toward integration with the Northern culture. So I give you two things. I think it's two, and with this we'll close. The first one is a prominent Jewish poet, Isaac Goldstein Halevi. Okay, 1865. You can see the explanation a little bit on the bottom. And this is an acrostic written in Hebrew. And if you take a look at the Hebrew letters, Avraham, not Abraham, Avraham
Lincoln,
right? Lincoln. Okay. So, and each one goes through. Micha Mocha, he says, for example, it says, Ashrecha Lincoln Micha Mocha. Right? How praiseworthy are you, Lincoln? No one is like you, and all the way down the whole thing. This is at the museum, so that gives you a sense. And if you look at the last page, so I gave you also, I figured this would be appropriate for Mikveh Israel. Okay, so this is right here in Philadelphia, the synagogue of the congregation Mikveh Israel published this shortly after the passing of Lincoln, and the Reverend S. Moraes, who is the rabbi of Mikveh Israel, is a fairly well-known name, I think, in Philadelphia circles. He writes a prayer. This is actually this first section is from the president's shul, and then there's a prayer for Lincoln. And I think in many ways this sort of tells the story of where things have gone. In other words, throughout the 1860s, Jews remained true to their roots in places like Charleston and places like Richmond, and Rabbi Rifel can get up and say something like this. But throughout the course of the war, and by the end of the war, Jews begin slowly but surely to move over toward a Union kind of mindset, and that is embodied in their love in particular for Lincoln himself, especially. And really this begins a process of integration with a Northern kind of mindset. And with that, over the course of the next 100 years, will come a greater sensitivity towards civil rights, human rights, anti-slavery attitudes seep into the Jewish community as they do to America in general, and things begin to change. So that by the time we get to the 1960s, much, much later, we're already at a very different moment in history where Jews are much more integrated with these new values of a greater sensitivity and awareness of universal human rights, and really things that Lincoln himself embodied 100 years prior, but the Jews slowly but surely come around to, so that by that time we're not only accepting of civil rights, but really very much, as we'll see next time, in the vanguard. Next time, God willing, we'll examine that. We're not only going to examine Jews in the civil rights movement, but we're going to look at Orthodox rabbis. Look at Orthodox rabbis and examine that. I actually I sent in my first, I'd written one piece for them, but I wrote my first op-ed for or the Jewish exponent, on this topic.
First one?
Wait, get this. This is my first one. I wrote one parsha piece for them, on Shavuos, a chag piece for them, a year and a half ago. And then what?
In that Guest Rabbi column?
I don't even know where to finish. And I wrote, I think it's going to be the first op-ed ever in the Jewish exponent about Rav Aharon Soloveitchik. So I'm intending to make history. Is that a fair guess?
That's unbelievable.
What? I think so. So I think it's very important. It's a very different part of the Philadelphia Jewish community, but I think it's extremely important for there to be a sense of connection and continuity, and for us to share our ideas with that broader community. What?
Is it published when?
This coming week. Right before MLK Day. So I think, I don't know who else is going to write about Rav Aharon Soloveitchik. We take a look for that, and well, him and other Orthodox rabbis next week.
I just want some clarification. So was the respect and the love that the Jews had for Lincoln,
yeah,
was it based on the fact that Lincoln gave them protection, or was it because they really believed in that anti-slavery?
I think that it started with some self-interest, and just Lincoln was incredibly beloved across the board. But once they came to embrace him and everything he represented, I think that was part of the process of then the attitudes coming along with it. Obviously, we were a complicated community, like we are today. We're diverse. But I don't think it's that all Jews were enlightened and therefore they loved Lincoln. I think it was a little bit more the other way around.
Because I think that's what you left out, Rabbi, was again, yeah. Jews involved in the abolition movement.
Mm-hmm. Just because that's right, just because of time, and because I think that's what, and just the contrast with the 1960s, that's absolutely true. But just to see, like, for me, this was in a way the unexpected kind of role.
Well, there's Jews against civil rights too. There was Jews.
Absolutely, right. For sure. No, but I think there the Jews played a particularly prominent role and were especially outspoken. And of course, it's more complex in both ways. But I think that's the more surprising thing. So really my goal is to highlight what's unusual and unexpected more than to give the full portrait. I think that's important as well. But that was really the goal for this evening. Absolutely. If anyone's interested, I gave you as well. You can take home presents if anyone wants. This is an op-ed that was published in 1862, not too long before Grant actually passed away. And this is him much later in his career after he was president. This is, he's very, very pro-Jewish, but this political cartoon mocks his tears for Jewish suffering in Russia as being, as you can see, crocodile tears. Okay, that's a long-standing phrase, and it gives you a sense. So not everyone bought into the notion that Grant came around, although Jews voted for him in great numbers. He actually got the Jewish vote.
Before this or after? You're talking about
despite,
after this.
After he still this got event, the Jewish he ran vote. For president, yeah, in 1868.
Yeah. The Jews, and they'll vote for us anyway.
Well, I guess we believed him that he had done Harata.
Well, it was a big issue in the campaign, and he had to defend himself, and it was, it was a lot of back and forth. That was a major issue in his campaign. Thank you, everyone. See you next week.